Geekscape.com. Can the White Race Survive? Part 4. Egypt Continued. Now we come to the sad spectacle of decadence in Egypt, to the time of nightfall on one of the brightest pages of ancient history. The Dark Land of Egypt has come to be known as such, perhaps because of the almost complete veil that has covered the country of former brilliance, a veil of silence woven from the lethargy of a mongrelized people. What a pitiful thing we behold today in a slothful remnant of people, plainly bearing much blood of the Negro, trying to claim heirship to the noble race of pyramid builders, asserting pure descent from invincible old Thutmose III and his contemporary race. Of course, there is only a portion of the present inhabitants of Egypt who have any claim to descent from the ancient inhabitants of the land, namely the Copts. Since the last of the dynastic times, the coming and going of alien strains has been frequent, but we can be certain of one thing about Egypt. The old race of whites that built ancient Egypt has been totally extinct for over 2,000 years, as extinct as the present white builders of North America will be a few hundred years from now if its great genius is not turned seriously onto the labour of making further amalgamation impossible. By the frail thread of history, we can perceive, if we know to study with a definite objective before us, the feverish symptoms of mongrelization some hundreds of years before the time of Ramses II. During the first half of the known history of ancient Egypt, there were several times when fratricidal strife broke out, when factional groups struggled for supremacy, stifling, for a while, the prosperity which comes naturally to an energetic and capable people. But there was that reservoir of the people of a pure race, a race that always had one eye on the practical things of today, and the other on what further advance might be attained on the morrow. From out of that ready reservoir, there was ever plentiful material in genius and ambition, from which would surely come builders and leaders as capable, often more capable, than the previous ones. Always the setback of civil strife was overcome, and new achievements blessed the population. But there came a time, somewhere about 1500 BC, when it seems the cohesiveness of the people of the Nile Valley was weakening. The rebound to national unity and prosperity was not so wholesomely complete as had often been the case before. Lethargy, that insidious form of sleeping sickness so characteristic of the Negro and Negroid, was taking possession of the body politic. The will to be and to progress was on the wane. The decline was beginning, from which there was no complete rising again. Already before the great old Ramses II, the seeds of anarchy within were evident. The spiritual union of the people, necessary to fighting off the crowding enemies without, bearing down from Asia Minor, from the Mediterranean coast countries, and from Libya, was not as it had been in former days. It took a mighty man like the great Ramses to temporarily weld together the poor metal of too much alloy. When the old man died, after reigning 67 years, the intrigues of the petty nobles of the priestly class and of a myriad of pretenders began to stir more disunion. Merneptah, last surviving of Ramses' 13 sons, and already an old man, succeeded his father. Thus, an old man succeeded an old man, and great strength of rule could not be expected of him. However, he managed to maintain for 10 years what his mighty father had left him. When he died in 1215 BC, several short-lived rulers seized power successively. The decline became more rapid, anarchy and famine ravishing the people. For a time, Ramses III, perhaps a descendant of the Ramses line, restored a semblance of order, but with his death began the more definite period of decay. His son, Ramses IV, had an inglorious reign of 6 years and was succeeded by another weakling, Ramses V. The power of the priesthood was increasing as the kaleidoscopic changes of pharaohs went on for the next several years. The people evidently were more under the superstition-inspired power of the votaries of Amon and other gods than under that of the civil forces, as could be expected from a population becoming more and more negroid. Finally, after the accession of the last weak Ramessid, Ramses XII, we see the pharaonic power reduced to a miserable semblance of its former self. The pharaoh's authority in the delta is taken over by a petty king there, and the heir of the once great empire is compelled to flee to Thebes, where the royal seat of power had not been for 200 years. Here, he is almost completely under the power of Threor, the chief priest. Upper Egypt and Nubia are really his only remaining dominions. We find him, in order to build his sacred barge, pitifully begging cedar logs of Lebanon from a haughty Phoenician ruler, where his ancestors had demanded such as their royal tribute. Because of the rise of the sacerdotal power in Thebes, the rule of the pharaoh practically ceased, and a theocracy of the priestly craft became dominant, which fully sealed the disunity of the kingdom. A brief attempt at rulership by the Tanite kings occurred. Afterwards, a great portion of the lower valley fell under the sway of the Libyans, who had immigrated into the valley in great numbers. It is hard to gain a clear perspective of the succession of dynasties as outlined by Manetho, because at no time now was there a dynastic power that was inclusive of more than portions of Egypt, unless we except the Libyan Shishonk I, who for a time tried to revive the old glory of the empire. Petty rulers, priestly and otherwise, held sway here and there. It is true that Shishonk made his power felt outside Egypt, once plundering Jerusalem of the wealth Solomon had gathered, and he brought Nubia again under subjection, collecting tribute there, but his son and successor, Osorkon I, soon began to have his troubles with the turbulent and restless feudal princes who had been claiming more and more power in the state. Thebes of Upper Egypt, a center and stronghold of the priestly craft, had gradually passed into the control of the heavily negroid Nubians, perhaps soon after the time of Ramses II. Even during the time of the latter pharaoh, the Nubians must have been a large proportion of the priesthood. We cannot doubt but that the creeping mongrel mixture had, by the time of Ramses II, thoroughly saturated all the lower classes of most of Egypt above the delta region, while the latter was saved from submergence only by the constant inflow of Libyan and other Mediterranean and Asiatic white elements. The Libyan influence predominated, and as the Libyans were, perhaps, by this time, a tainted people themselves, we could not expect to see any great accomplishments from them. The petty bickerings among the little kinglets in the delta and further up the valley during the 22nd and 23rd dynasties reveal the fact that by 800 BC, even the delta had no more of the old-time spirit of revival or resurgence of greatness. There may have been some few families of the upper classes into whose veins the Negroid element had not infused its blood, but it was not so with the masses. A Thutmosis III or a Ramses II could not have taken tin and beaten it into gold. The metal with which to work had mixed into its grain a clinging element which could never be eliminated. We come to the time of Ethiopian supremacy. This submission by the people of the valley to Nubian overlordship would never have been had not the population in almost its entirety become mongrel. A branch of the Ammonite priesthood had built up a theocracy at Napata in Nubia. It gradually evolved into a self-styled kingdom of Egypt, claiming to rule all Egypt, arrogating to itself all the pharaonic titles for its king. Around 740 BC, Pianchi became king at Napata. By 721, he extended his authority as far north as Heracleopolis and garrisoned the country with Nubian soldiers. Later, he temporarily subjugated the delta, plundering its cities of their wealth and returning to Napata, leaving the delta to immediately reassert its independence. Pianchi sought control of the Theban Ammonite priesthood by having his sister wife, Amenardis, adopted by Shepnupit, sacerdotal princess of Thebes. It is not clear whether Amenardis was the mother of Taharqa, son of Pianchi, and destined to later become pharaoh. But if she was, being a sister of Pianchi, it means that even Pianchi was Negroid, for we know positively that Taharqa was distinctly Negroid of features, being credited as the first Negro to occupy the throne of the pharaohs. It may be that Taharqa was Pianchi's son by another wife who was a Negress. We read in Breasted's A History of the Ancient Egyptians. It is at this juncture that we can trace the rising fortunes of a son of Pianchi, Prince Taharqa, whose features, as preserved in contemporary sculptures, show unmistakably Negroid characteristics. After Pianchi, the latter's brother, Shabarqa, and after him, Shabataka, perhaps his son, ruled amidst growing confusion and impotence against foreign enemies. When Taharqa, succeeding Shabataka, ascended the throne at Tanis, we find him bringing his Negress mother there to be hailed with regal splendor as the Queen Mother. The material prosperity of Egypt started nearly 3,000 years before by the great old race of builders, was now throttled by the inability of the people and their incapable rulers to even maintain what they had inherited, much less build more. The irrigation canals were filling up and being abandoned to ruin, and other engineering works inherited by the now Negroid inhabitants were not continued. Its roads were unprotected, intercourse between communities became unsafe, productive capacity of the country rapidly waned, and the once buoyant foreign commerce entirely disappeared. An interesting picture of this period of Egypt was drawn by the great Israelite prophet Isaiah in chapter 21, containing, as the Israelite prophecies so often do, the double significance of future literal and symbolical fulfillment. The immediate fulfillment, in a literal sense, came soon after Isaiah pronounced it, and in an unmistakable manner. As the Bible is easily available to all students, it is unnecessary to quote the entire chapter here, but I would call special attention to verses 11 to 15 inclusive. Breasted believes the Noph of the 13th verse refers to Napata, the seat of the Ethiopian pharaohs. Old Isaiah in verse 11, questions significantly the mongrelized incompetence sitting on the degenerated throne of the once great Pharaonic line. How say ye unto Pharaoh, I am the son of the wise, the son of ancient kings? For a number of years, after the Assyrians first began to encroach upon Egypt, there was a struggle between them and the Ethiopian rulers, the latter generally giving way while the northern armies were upon them, then seeking to re-establish their authority in the lower valley and the delta the minute the Ninevites withdrew the main body of their army. The Assyrians, tired of this program, and invaded the Nile Valley, and for the last time drove the Ethiopians from the delta and forced their inglorious retreat into the far south, sacked and left the noble city of Thebes in ruins, ever to remain a silent witness to a civilization buried without hope of resurrection. Then the northerners withdrew and occupied themselves with other troubles on distant frontiers. At this juncture, Breasted says, at a time when Assyria was dominating the east, without a worthy rival elsewhere to stay her hand, it was to be expected that the historic people of the Nile should confront her and dispute her progress on even terms. To this great task, the Ethiopians were appointed, but in fact, Assyria was never dealing with a first-class power in her conquest of Egypt. The Nubians were not the men to reorganize a long decadent and disorganized nation, and the unhappy Nile dwellers, in hopeless impotence, looked in vain for a strong ruler throughout the supremacy of the inglorious Ethiopians. Withdrawing to Napata, the Ethiopians never made another attempt to subdue the kingdom of the lower river, but gave their attention to the development of Nubia. As the Egyptians resident in the country died out and were not replaced by others, the Egyptian gloss which the people had received began rapidly to disappear, and the land relapsed into a semi-barbaric condition. The theocratic character of the government became more and more pronounced until the king was but a puppet in the hands of the priests, at whose behest he was obliged even to take his own life and make way for another weakling whom the priests might choose. The nation soon turned its face southwards. By 560 BC, the Nubian kings were occupying their new capital, far above the Fifth Cataract, known to the Greeks as Meroe. As the nation shifted southwards, it was completely withdrawn from contact with the northern world, and Ethiopia, gradually lost behind a mist of legend, became the wonderland celebrated in Greek story as the source of civilization. The Egyptian language and hieroglyphics, which the kings had hitherto used for their records, now slowly disappeared, and by the beginning of our era, the native language was finally written in a script which is as yet undeciphered. When a century or two after the Roman conquests, the Ethiopian kingdom slowly collapsed and fell to pieces, its northern districts were absorbed by wild hordes of the Blemmyes, who pushed in from the east, while in the south it was succeeded by the Christian kingdom of Abyssinia, which rose at the source of the Blue Nile in the 4th century AD, and finally acquired the name of its ancient Ethiopian predecessors. There is no use following the petty rulership of Lower Egypt further. The splendor of Egypt was finished. Alien forces came and went. The Persians came and collected tribute for a time. Alexander conquered the sickened land. The Romans took it over as a matter of course in their imperial world sway. But Egypt was dead. The later center of learning at Alexandria was not conserved by Egyptians, but by a polyglot collection of Easterners, Judeans, Greeks, Phoenicians, Libyans, and other white savants who gathered there by custom as students today at Columbia University represent every corner of the globe. The pure old white race that thrived in this unique valley, the like of which exists nowhere else in the world, was wiped out forever. In its place moped the lethargic descendants of Egyptian and Negro blended, intellects enervated, spirits blighted. So the land has remained to this day an easy prey to foreign invasion and vassalage. Never again has there been a true, homogeneous, united, strong race of pure Egyptians as ruled over by Khufu and Thutmose III. The only hope, if they were only capable of realizing it, of the present polyglot population of Egypt for unbroken peace and prosperity lies in the continued suzerainty of a strong white power, just as will have to be adopted for all the rest of the mongrelized world, as time proves their inability to govern themselves.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.